access number 10657, and this is reel 23.
Major Lewis, reel 23. I think we had got to the stage where you'd returned to the battalion in Tunisia after your convalescence.
Yes. what I've done actually is to just go back to immediately after the Battle of Alamein, because quite a few interesting things happened to the battalion before, in fact, they got up to Tripoli. By November the 3rd, the decisive tank battle of Tel El Akakir had taken place, which followed, of course, the supercharge breakthrough, and the RAF reported hundreds of vehicles going west on the coast road. Now, for the next couple of days, the 8th Battalion reorganized. A and B companies, which had both been pretty badly knocked about during supercharge, were amalgamated. And on November the 4th, 37 ORs arrived, reinforcements, and were posted to C Company. They were all Welshmen, some territorials from the Welsh Regiment and the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. On their arrival, it was quite obvious that they resented having to join a regiment other than their own. But in fact, they soon settled down with the battalion, in fact, were very much involved in the Marath battle and put up a very good performance. They soon settled in with the Durhams. On the 8th of November, the brigadier told the officers of the battalion that the attack by the DLI brigade and the Scottish brigades had done the trick, supercharge. So that was a nice compliment to get. The 8th Battalion moved to El Darba. Both sides of the road were being used by the transport moving up. There were columns of Germans and Italian POWs marching back more or less unescorted. And for the first time in the war, we actually saw German officers marching back to the rear unescorted. The morale of quite a lot of the troops and of some of the officers had been completely shattered by the supercharge barrage and the battle that followed. It was at this stage, of course, that the Germans decided that it was more important to keep their own army intact than the Italians, and the Italians had to walk. The Germans pinched most of the Italian transport, in fact. Now, the DLI brigade was not in the pursuit from Alamein onwards. The next big thing that happened was that on November the 8th, the Anglo-American forces landed in Morocco and Algeria, and a few days later, the 8th Battalion moved back to reserve positions a few miles behind the sector in the Alamein line that they had held down in the south. Now, most of November and December was comparatively quiet. 6 new officers and 200 other ranks arrived, but I don't have any note of where they came from. There were NCO training cadres were started. There was section and platoon training. Jake was very much in favour of training as soon as the troops come out of battle. He reckoned that most value is gained from training under those circumstances. Even so, a football pitch was set up and there was a certain amount of recreation. Jake, the commanding officer, that's Lieutenant Colonel Jackson, also organised a visit for some officers, that's to say the ones who'd been in the Alamein box, to the battalion's old positions in the Alamein line. He then he and the and the chaps with him then saw our lines from the German and Italian viewpoint, and it was very interesting indeed for them to be able to have a look at, for them to see what the Germans and Italians had seen of our section of the line. Fortunately, bearing in mind that the Anger Depression was still very, very heavily mined, very much a mine-infested area, there weren't any casualties on mines, but this, of course, is partly due to the fact that they were moving about by day and not by night. Immediately following this, there was an absolute outbreak of jaundice, and the flies were absolutely awful. Millions of flies, they swarmed around the remains of the camps and the dumps, the cookhouses, the latrines, and in fact they were worse than they had been at Gazala or when we cleared up the Maori positions. The medical officer Andrew Noble, together with the battalion pioneer platoon, the battalion sanitary squad, built some arsenic fly traps, which were pretty effective, and in fact they did manage to more or less wipe out the flies. Benghazi had been captured by the 20th of November, and on December the 6th, I think it was, 50 Div was ordered forward into Libya to Sidi Rezegh. And the route was across the desert from Mersa Matru, and the troop carriers were putting in about 70 or 80 miles a day on average. Christmas, just before Christmas 1942, training started in 50 Div in earnest. Particular attention was paid to infantry tank cooperation, and in particular, carrying rifle sections into battle on the back of tanks. Christmas 1942, this was very well organised by George Stray, the quartermaster, and Captain Petro Cochino, known to everyone as Petro, the PRI. They made frequent visits to the NAFI and to Brook. And here was the battalion, 400 miles from the Delta, in the middle of the desert, having roast turkey and pork on Christmas Day, roast potatoes and dried greens, followed by Christmas pudding with rum sauce, oranges, and a free bottle of beer, served by the officers and the NCOs. I think I mentioned before that we were very fortunate in the battalion in having a first-rate quartermaster and a first-rate PRI who did work extremely hard to make sure that the troops really got something good.
What does PRI mean?
Well, I think it's something to do with President of the Regimental
Institute.
I think that's right.
So he was really concerned with things like
welfare
and
right
celebration.
Exactly. And worked very closely with George Stray, the QM, and Petro went right through the war, actually. Was mainly back at rear battalion HQ or even back at B echelon. He was a very good bloke. He did, I suppose you could say that he did part of the work that the Padre could do. But as I say, we were very lucky. People like George made life bearable on those occasions. I mean, they didn't have to go and queue up at the NAFI in Tobruk. They could have taken what was pushed out to them, you know, but they went there day after day, and it was quite a long trip across the desert. Now, after Christmas, Colonel Jackson decided to take some of the officers and NCOs back to the Gazala box. They got there to find that things had been left more or less as they were 6 months before. Corporal Cutty, who was the officers' mess corporal, his watch was still on the tent pole in the officers' mess cookhouse, where he'd left it. And Ian English, Captain English, dug up a pair of boots and in fact wore them for most of the rest of the war until they almost disintegrated. The Germans and the Italians hadn't occupied the Gazala positions. They were far too fluid and they were moving on after we broke out. And the Bedouin had found the hidden supplies of food and water that we hadn't taken with us on the breakout. But they hadn't taken anything like cookers, picks, shovels, tables and tents. So most of these things were loaded onto a 3-ton lorry and taken back to the battalion.
So the Bedouin weren't really interested in anything that wasn't instantly usable.
Well, that rather looks like it, yes. Yes, there's no doubt about it, they found where the water and the food had been buried. But as I say, there were lots of things they didn't take with them. New Year's Day, the battalion moved to a gala, and soon after that, they experienced one of the first of the rainstorms in the desert, which were pretty horrific, really. The vehicles were absolutely bogged down in a squelching mess of mud and sand. They had to push them, tow them, dig them out, and I think they had 3 days of torrential rain from January the 3rd to January the 6th. Unbelievable in its intensity. Now finally the battalion arrived at the tented camp under the Benina escarpment and next to the airfield at Benina. It was a few miles inland from the port of Benghazi. Now what had happened in Benghazi is that the storm had created absolute havoc in the port. 4 ships had been sunk, one with 2,000 tons of ammunition, and the daily intake of supplies dropped. General Montgomery had to change his plans for the next attack, which was to be at Buerat, B-U-E-R-A-T, and it would now be only a 3-division attack instead of a 4-division one, so 50 div was left out, but had to provide 39 men and 19 3-tonners to ferry supplies from Tobruk to Buerat. Benghazi was a completely dead town. Most of the civilian population had left, and it was no big deal, in fact, to be able to get into Benghazi. By about Jan 17, the German resistance had been broken, and in the early hours of the 23rd of January, Tripoli was entered. This was 1,400 miles from Alamein, to give some idea of the distances involved, and in fact Tripoli fell 3 months to the day after the Alamein Battle had started. Now we come to the next obstacle for the 8th Army, which was the French-built Marath Line. Okay.
Yeah. What happened to you when you got back? You said that you had a rather...
When I got back to Benghazi...
You got back to the battalion.
To Benina, yes. I got back.
You had
to
a fairly starchy greeting from the...
Yes.
...commander.
Nobody expecting to see me, I don't think. Well, I think having got back to the battalion, there were quite a lot of new officers that I hadn't seen before who had come up with the reserves and that sort of thing. But if I remember rightly, I would have got B Company back at that time. I would have got my company back, which I had had at Alamein.
How did you find your company? Had it been changed?
Well, I can't remember an awful lot about that because, you see, as soon as we got up, immediately after the Battle of Alamein, A and B companies were amalgamated, what was left of A and B companies, and I don't suppose they were formed into 2 separate companies again until we were established under the escarpment at Benina. And I honestly can't remember. I would have thought there would have been a lot of new people in actual fact. My Sergeant Major was still there, Sergeant Major Brannigan, he was still there, But of course, none of the platoon commanders, they'd all gone. So I had completely new platoon commanders. I remember rightly, I had a new second in command, Foster Gedge. I had Doug Pentney as platoon commander, Bill Bailey as a platoon commander, and Jim Randall, none of whom had been in the Alamein show.
Had you known any of them before?
No. These were all that had come up with the reinforcements. Certainly Pentney and Bailey had come back from hospital. Pentney had come up with the reinforcements. Foster Gedge, I don't remember, he was an old TA man, I think, so he might have been somewhere else at the Echelon or something.
But did you have a full complement of officers?
For merit I did, but how soon they got together at Benina, I don't know, but we would have started putting it together then. But by the time we got to Merith, I did in fact have a full complement. I had a second in command and three platoon commanders and a sergeant major.
What was your main priority then when you were at Benina? What were you doing?
Well, I can tell you what happened there actually. We were 7 weeks under the escarpment from January the 7th to about March the 1st. I got back to the battalion round about the 26th of January. It was a period of fairly intensive training with section and platoon schemes. An assault course was built. 505 Field Company gave us a lot of instruction in mines and booby traps, and the battalion exercised quite a lot in the Jebel Akhdar, A-C-H-D-A-R, which was known as the Green Hills. It was a sort of mountain warfare in miniature. Now what that was for I don't know, because we weren't going to be involved in any mountain warfare in Marath. Whether anybody had an inkling of the fact that we were going to do Sicily and had to climb a very, very steep hill immediately after getting ashore, I don't know. But we did do this mountain warfare training, or a form of mountain warfare, in the hills. There was also an exercise called Climber, and this was an assault by night against positions on an escarpment. Again, no connection whatsoever with what was going to happen at Marath. We did some street fighting in Benghazi as well. Each rifle company marched into Benghazi from Benina for 3 days at the 10th Corps Street Fighting School. It was a heavily bombed and uninhabited part of Benghazi. We fired all our weapons, Brens. We tossed grenades through doors and windows, all that sort of business. We had machine guns supporting company attacks from the roof of a building, which disturbed the Royal Naval HQ, and in particular the Naval Paymaster's office on the top floor, which they weren't very happy about, and he got a burst of Cheshire machine gun fire through there. And on one occasion, a 2-pounder anti-tank gun shell went through the walls of 22 houses before it finally came to stop. So we were pretty busy with our training at Benina, in actual fact.
What was it that was distinctive about the training in the Jebel Akhdar? How does mountain warfare training, as you did it?
Well, I mean, I've said mountain war. We called it mountain warfare in miniature, but it could have no. It had absolutely no connection with anything that we were likely to do in the near future. At least I can't remember that it did. I think it was purely and simply. It was moving around in hilly country, basically, having spent a hell of a long time moving around in the desert, which was anything but. So I suppose really it was an effort to get to acclimatise the battalion a little into the sort of conditions we wouldn't necessarily be getting immediately, but might suddenly find ourselves dropped into.
And what about the street fighting? I mean, how did you go about clearing a street of houses?
How did we go about
clearing a street of houses?
Well, that was done in the traditional sort of manner, you know. I mean, like you see it done these days. when you're going into a house, you get somebody on either side of the door, you burst the door open, and you toss a grenade in, and then you both stay back on this side of the door until the grenade's gone off, and then follow it in with a few bursts of Tommy gun fire. That was basically what it was about, really. And clearing a street as quickly as you possibly could. But there again, you see, we didn't get involved in any street fighting for a hell of a long time.
When you were clearing a street, did you work both sides of it at once? With...
Can't recollect that. I doubt whether we would have... I don't know. I would think you would have to do that, in actual fact. I would think so, because you'd be exposed otherwise from windows opposite while you were actually clearing a particular house.
Unless you kept yourself parallel.
Well, you could. I think you would have had two groups moving down on either side of the street, both dealing, one dealing with the left-hand side, one with the right, and each of them able, more or less, to protect the back of the other group.
To be giving mutual support.
Yes, I think so, yes.
That would require a fair bit of practice to establish coordination, wouldn't it?
Well, except that you'd both be doing a separate job. You'd have to make sure that you didn't go... that you didn't, for instance... fall back or go too much ahead of the chaps on the other side. That would have been the difficult part about it, maintaining a steady sort of movement with each group more or less level.
The machine gun, you mentioned the Cheshires acting in support. What would their role be in a street clearing operation?
Well, it depends where they were. I mean, if they were on top of a building and they got a good position up there and they could see right down to the far end of the street that you were clearing, they could fire over your heads at something, at a target, way ahead of you, in fact. So they would be in a static position.
What, suppress any...
Well, yes, I mean, really, to get high enough up to be able to fire over the heads of the troops they're supporting at something in the near distance. I think that's fair. And of course, this is when they actually put a burst through the roof of the Naval HQ, because they were in a fairly high position and they obviously shot at something, but they were firing too high and loosed off a few in that direction.
And the anti-tank guns, what would their role be? Would it simply be to protect your infantry from any armour?
Yeah, well, I don't really know. I can't think. I mean, that would, I suppose, yes, would be... that would have been the role of a two-pounder anti-tank gun in case any armour did come round the corner or something like that. But how they managed to lose something off that went through that number of walls, I don't know.
Would depend on what the walls were made of, presumably.
Yes, quite very, very thin stuff. Paper mache, more or less, I should think. But it was interesting. I mean, the sort of hilly country training and the street fighting training. I mean, in fact, everybody liked this street fighting training very much. They found it extremely interesting, totally different to what they'd been doing. And you could say it might have been introduced as a means of sort of diverting people's minds from the sort of warfare they've been fighting, something entirely different, freshen them up, get them enthusiastic, get morale back, and that sort of thing.
Certainly you would have to be athletic, wouldn't you, in street fighting?
Yes, a lot of these things, because in a place like Benghazi, a lot of them would only be just one floor places with a flat roof or something like that, you know. Yes, you've got to be pretty fit to do these things. If I remember rightly, I think we got up, when we were at Benina, we were up every morning doing PT, which was considered by quite a few people to be one of the great disadvantages of not being in the front line. Because there's nothing worse than a miserable, awful, cheerless, tented camp that Benina was on a freezing cold morning, sloshing about in mud and what have you, and doing physical training. Highly demoralising.
You mentioned also the engineers training you with on mines and booby traps. Presumably that was much more relevant to what you were going to be doing.
Very much so. But I think possibly, I mean, there were quite a few different types of mines. You know, it was not only necessary to know what type of mine you might uncover with a bayonet, but it was necessary also, if you had to do the job of disarming it, to try and let people know a little bit about how you went about that. They were pretty good, our 505 field company, actually, and they went to a great deal of trouble, and we did learn quite a bit about mines. But I must admit myself, I don't know many people who really felt confident to have a go themselves, other than our own pioneer platoon, to have a go themselves and try and disarm one. The thing to do was to mark up where it was with something, sticking up by it, and leave it there. Just brush the sand off of the top so it could be seen, and let it be dealt with by the engineers or the pioneers.
And what sort of booby traps were you shown?
Well, I think possibly the booby traps would have been partly to do with the street fighting. You know, you get quite a lot of booby traps under those conditions. You also get booby traps on abandoned trucks or abandoned tanks, and unfortunately on dead bodies, which happened after the Marathon battle, when our stretcher bearers went down to the Wadi to try and recover some of the bodies. We actually lost a stretcher bearer who was killed because one of them had been booby trapped. That was the Italians, it wasn't the Germans. I think mainly the engineers were telling us where we ought to be careful and make and look for booby traps, which could be in this sort of place or that sort of place or under those conditions. So we did get to know quite a bit more about mines and how to avoid them and how to avoid the booby traps than anything else. Not so much a question of defusing them or making them safe. Okay. Does that cover that bit all right? Can I just go back a little bit about the Marath line before the training? As I said, the next obstacle for the 8th Army, the next big obstacle, was the French-built Marath line, which was 160 miles west of Tripoli. You add the two together, you've got something like nearly 1,600 miles from Marath back to the Delta. Tripoli had been devastated by the Germans. They'd carried out a lot of demolitions in the harbour. But the reserves had to be built up, and by Feb 10, 2,000 tons of supplies were being handled through Tripoli. By the 17th, the 8th Army had closed up on the Marath line, and Medinin had been captured. Soon after this, Rommel left and returned to Germany and did not return to command the Africa Corps. And General Montgomery set about preparing for the Marath battle.
Were you aware at the time that Rommel had left?
No, I don't think that got through to us, actually. No.
Would it have had any effect if it had, do you think? Did Rommel have a...
Oh, Rommel was considered to be a very clever general, you know, I think... The way that he had led his army, the Africa Corps, up until Alamein was pretty faultless. You know, his outflanking of the Gazala line and his withdrawals in the earlier stages to Benghazi, but then the moves forward again. I think people respected Rommel as a good general. And I mean, in the same way that we respected the Africa Corps as pretty fair adversaries, You know, there was no dirty work with the Africa Corps. They were pretty... they were professional, highly trained, wonderfully equipped desert army. And they were a very, very... they were a fighting machine that that was pretty good and highly thought of by us. But the fact that Rommel had gone back to Germany, I think we wouldn't have thought one way or the other about it, I don't think.
It wouldn't have been taken as a portent that...
Oh, no, I don't think so, no. I think that by then, we knew that we'd got them on the run to the extent that we weren't going to have to pull back all the way again from Tripoli back to Alamein, if you like. That at last we'd actually got there, and this time we were going to stay. And that was the feeling of the officers and the troops, definitely. Rommel, I think what was given out for one of the reasons was he was sick or something at one stage. But no, I think that we knew then that we'd got the upper hand, particularly after the the Medinine battle, which in fact was another Alam Halfa, perfectly fought defensive battle by General Montgomery, and the Germans failed completely to penetrate the British positions. Well, that sort of news gets back pretty quickly, you know, and I think that probably, we knew we got a tough job coming up with the Marath line, but as I say, officers and troops all reckoned that we were on top at that time.